Adam very nicely summarized it with a question at the break. He said, we've got three pieces of a puzzle, and I don't understand how they go together. The three pieces of the puzzle that I introduced in the last hour is first the idea that instead of consciousness being related to the world, it's going to be related to its ways of comprehending the world. So the movement from consciousness to self-consciousness. The consciousness is going to be interrogating itself, its ways of relating to the world. Secondly, I said that the kind of being that does this is an acting and desiring being. So the primacy of desire and agency. And third, we got this story about life. And the question is, how do they all hang together? And the answer is, I'm not going to tell you. Because the answer does not... So if you are puzzled, you are right to be puzzled. Hegel does not bring these three things together in this section. They will only come together in the master-slave relationship itself. So you have to be very patient and let these things hang as so far moments that are each motivated by the argument to date, but each not clear how they interconnect. So what I want to do for the next hour is introduce a massive aside. And the aside is to try to think about what the next, what this transformation in the book is about, what it means. And the important thing here is that the transition from consciousness to self-consciousness, in fact, emerges as a complete transformation of the conceptual grid of modern philosophy. And I want to talk about this complete transformation of this conceptual grid. It's not completely unanticipated. It's a little bit in Herder and a little bit in Fichte, but it really doesn't come together until Hegel. And what is going to change is that instead of the relation between a subject and an object, it is going to be a relation at least between two subjects, hence a story about intersubjectivity. Instead of a relation between a subject knowing or cognizing an object, it is going to be a relation of recognition. I'm going to say what that word means, what recognition means. Hence, whatever it is more than and different from a pure cognitive encounter. That our way of being in the world is not by cognizing the world. And instead of the relation being external, a subject knowing another independent subject and vice versa, the relation is going to be an internal relation. That is, my relation to the other is going to be a component of my self-relation. So that my fundamental relationship to myself, who I am for myself, hence who I am and what it means to be me, becomes essentially mediated through my relation to another. Finally, because the relation between self and other is going to be both internal and external, then what is at stake in recognition is not the grasping of a truth external to myself, but, let's say, the quality of my relation to the other. So I'm going to elaborate all those points for a bit. As Hegel says in paragraph 184, they recognize themselves as mutually recognizing one another. He seems to be suggesting that normatively, recognition requires equality and mutuality. It is often assumed that equality and mutuality together require absolute symmetry, like a mirroring relationship. But I shall be arguing that this is not the case. Mutuality requires reversibility, not symmetry. Any of you who have ever, say, made love with another person might recognize that fault. It took a while. Thinking about it, yeah, reverse. Yeah, I get it. Okay. Good. So reversibility, not symmetry. If it was symmetry, well, it doesn't bear thinking about it. Nonetheless, what follows from this thought is that a new form of human failure is announced. Let's call it misrecognition. Misrecognition is the form of non-correspondence to the other governing human social relations. Misrecognition is what causes a form of consciousness to become dissatisfying. And misrecognition is that which engenders a mode of encounter as self-defeating. Or rather, that's the crux of Hegel's argument. That is, he must show that all acts of mixed recognition are equally forms of self-defeating forms of behavior. So misrecognition for Hegel is the source of inequality and unfreedom. Misrecognition is hence the type of failure intrinsic to human sociality. And therefore, misrecognition is equally the source of what I call moral injury. That is, the way in which one human being harms another human being as a human being. You can harm people in a variety of ways, but to harm them as a human being, I'm going to argue, is misrecognition, and therefore it is a fundamental form of injury, and therefore you should be thinking of the master-slave relationship as the paradigmatic form of moral injury and misrecognition. All these forms of failure are going to be announced in the encounter between the master and slave. Misrecognition and the dissatisfactions it generates also are the ultimate cause for the fundamental forms of world denial. What Nietzsche calls the ascetic ideal, and Weber, the fundamental forms of world rejection. And these are analyzed in the chapters on Stoicism, Skepticism, and the unhappy consciousness. That's a lot. And therefore, we better be clear what's happening here. All this stuff that I just said is going on in the master-slave. Then we need to stand back and figure out what this shift is about and what its stakes are. Recognition is Hegel's successor term to love and life. Love will hence become one form of recognitive relation. But there are many, many, many others. To say that recognition is the successor term to love means roughly that recognition involves eliciting and isolating the conceptual infrastructure of the kind of intersubjective relation which love relations exhibit. So I'm doing that thing that everyone thinks should not be done, namely trying to find within love a conceptual infrastructure that articulates why it's meaningful in the way it is. Further, recognition as a successor concept to love aims at a form of satisfaction, which is, I guess, Hegel's word for happiness. That is analogous to the kind of satisfaction that love relationships normatively embody. So recall again that in love we find the meaning and worth of our life in the other, that we cannot detach how things are for us, the waning and waxing of my life, from the life of the other, and that the miseries of love derive from the fact, again, to quote Carson McCullers, from the fact that the lover and the beloved come from different countries. What distinguishes love from recognition is that erotic love is driven by a fusion model, while recognition is not. Hence, recognition elicits the normative element in love relations apart from its other qualities. Okay. Recognition, anerkennen, is a form of cognition, erkennen. So, like cognition, recognition has a double structure. It is a relation between a self and an object, and as a relation between a self and itself. As a relation between self and object, recognition denotes a special kind of object, an object that is a subject. Because the object is a subject, then recognizing is not a matter of fact epistemic achievement, like distinguishing between apples and pears. It's not a matter of classifying, it's not a matter of knowing the object's properties. Therefore, not everything that is involved in recognizing another as a subject can be cashed out in purely cognitive terms. It cannot be cashed out in terms of epistemic discrimination, that is, in picking out just those properties which only subjects possess. Rather, recognizing another involves according him or her a certain status or worth, and responding to them in the light of that status and worth. So, when Israel fails to recognize the Palestinians, they're not making an epistemological error. They're not confusing the Palestinians with the Iranians or thinking that they're secretly Syrians. Rather, they're not according them the same value or worth that they would want others to accord them. So recognizing is a way of treating another, responding to another, in a manner that acknowledges a certain standing or value or worth. Let's say that to recognize another as a subject is to accord them a certain value in themselves, as valuable in themselves. So, self-conscious agents, that's you and me, conceive of ourselves as sources of value. At the very least, that thought is given by the desire model. Just by desiring, I'm a source of value and meaning. Things have value and meaning through my desiring them. And therefore expect others to so regard them. Now, we typically think of according someone or group a status as being of a certain worth as driven by certain feelings of respect, of sympathy, of esteem. And the withholding of recognition causes the object to feel disrespect, to lack the opportunity for self-esteem, to feel existentially isolated. From this, if just this notion of recognition is right, two things immediately follow. First, recognition is as much a practical relation between selves as it is epistemic, cognitive or theoretical. I both have to recognize you as having certain features and treat you accordingly. Right? That's a practical fact that has to be grounded in an assessment of you. Hence, there's a practical character to it. Hence, the transition again from consciousness to self-consciousness is a transition from the primacy of theoretical reason to the primacy of practical reason. To say that the relationship is practical is to say that the manner of my regard entails both motives for action and a manner of engaging or encountering the other, a mode of form of treatment. It requires a stance or an orientation or an attitude. Recognition, therefore, corresponds to what Stanley Cavell calls acknowledgement, where acknowledgement provides the practical normative binding between selves above and beyond knowledge itself. So Cavell says, just to remind you of this argument, you see what the stakes are here. Cavell says that the problem of other minds, how do I know that the person in front of me is another subject, another mind like my own? He says, the mistake has been to think that that's an epistemic question that's searching for a certain amount of evidence. And the thing is no amount of evidence will satisfy me that another is another subject like me. That evidence is the wrong kind of thing to look for. And Cavell says, this is what Cavell means by the truth of skepticism. The skepticism says, you know, any evidence you give me that you're a subject is never going to be enough. And Cavell says, that's true. But that's to say that my relationship to the other is not a matter of consciousness, where we just were. The search for definitive evidence that the other is another subject, the search for definitive evidence that my wife truly loves me, is bound to fail. Hence, Cavell's account, nothing is going to count for Othello as having perfect evidence that Desdemona loves him. And yet that's what he seems to want. Othello seems to want evidence, and the attempt to elicit that evidence and find proof of it kills her, kills him, destroys him. So it is because self-consciousness is a practical relation of self to world, that Hegel places all the complex epistemic reflections of the understanding under the heading of consciousness and not self-consciousness. For Hegel, the transcendental unity of apperception, the form of self-consciousness Kant described to the understanding, is not truly self-conscious. Remember my argument about 20 minutes ago where I said, reading a book, being conscious, I'm not self-aware. Only as I desire, get hungry. So the pure contemplating theoretical self is not aware of itself as a self-conscious being. It's not that he's not a self, or she's not a self-conscious being. It's that it is a moment in which self-consciousness is suppressed. To actually conceive of knowing as a self-conscious achievement is again to think of it as a practical engagement with the world. Secondly, now kind of agreeing with Kant, to regard another as another subject is to regard her as an end in herself. Only now, the regarding of others as ends in themselves is not merely a reflection on my motives and my intentions, but directly a mode of perception and encounter. A way of seeing the other and the modes of activity involved. So recognition and misrecognition finally come to replace all the relationships between self and the law, self and the moral law, self and principle that Kant had put there. But Hegel thinks it all happens between you and me. So let's say from now on, what is at stake, and I'll put this as hyperbolically as I can, is the slow discovery that the other is the fact of reason. Remember, the fact of reason in the Critique of Practical Reason was my awareness of myself as free and self-determining. So the awareness of the moral law lifts me out of myself and makes me aware of myself as a self-conscious being. I'm saying it's the other that exposes me to my own freedom and rationality. And hence the other is itself, herself, the fact of reason. A thought, right, this is where people always are surprised that I so despise Levinas. And of course, Levinas gets the idea that the other is the fact of reason. He beats the thought to death. And that's the problem. He doesn't think it. He just beats it to death. Hegel wants to ask the question how it is we come to learn, how it is we come to experience the other as the fact of reason. And he assumes that this is something that has to be learnt and developed through a complicated process and cannot be understood in its normative significance, right, in terms of an immediate model of infinite obligation. There's no immediate infinite obligation to the other. As we're about to see, my first response to the existence of the other is killer. Of course, that is my exposure to the other. Levinas is right about that. But he refuses everything, everything that's difficult for thought. I don't understand the project and why he doesn't like Hegel. Puzzled. I've always been puzzled. So to say that my relations to myself are mediated through my relations to others is to say that the quality or character of my relation to myself, my very being for myself, is mediated through my being for another. But this is to say that the question of recognition embeds my standing for myself, my status as being self-identical in relation to others. That is, how I take myself in its simplest and most primitive form only emerges and takes on a characteristic through my relation to others and has no moment of independence from that. There is no cogito ergo sum, there is no I equals I, independently of these complex mediations of self and others. So Hegel is going to say that my very subjectivity, my self-consciousness, is socially constituted. That the most obvious fact about me, that I'm self-aware of myself as a being in the world, is a social product. Indeed, a social achievement of a certain kind. Crudely, my being for myself has two fundamental senses. First, it denotes the actualization of an indeterminate potentiality, hence a becoming who you are through your efforts of creative self-transformation, where creative self-transformation is, in Hegel's jargon, the externalization of being in itself. Second, my being for the being for itself involves, and I'm going to go through two moments, my absolute independence from the other. Hence an affirmation of my freedom as achieved through efforts of self-determination. If my being for self, and this, what I'm going to be doing here, by the way, is generating a paradox. So let me start. I'm going to say that we have a moment of absolute independence, absolute being for self, an infinite self-regard, and simultaneously and structured with it and mediated by it, an infinite dependence, and therefore an infinite relation to the other. And I'm going to call those two moments the moments of separateness and connectedness.
Is the separateness also infinite? Are they both infinite?
Absolutely. They're both infinite, which is why it's a real paradoxical relation. I have to have a moment, and I have to show how that's possible, that they're both moments can be infinite in the appropriate way. So, yeah.
What do you mean by these things? You mean I'm qualified? That I'm independent in some absolute and unqualified way, and I'm dependent in some absolute way?
Yes.
Okay.
I do.
Infinity scares me.
Okay. So there is a sense in which I am unconditionally independent of the other. And the answer to that, by the way, is the source of that is I can always say no. Possibly of negativity. The other cannot touch my freedom. That's my infinite independence. My infinite dependence is that my freedom is always mediated through the regard of the other. And hence, I'm always in a situation of passivity. So, Hegel calls these moments independence and dependence. I use the phrase separateness and connectedness. So I'm saying that there's a fundamental structure of the human in its status of being a self-conscious being that is a structure of separateness and connectedness. And that's going to raise all sorts of issues if you've got these two utter unconditional moments. So the first moment, that moment of independence, is what in psychoanalytic language is the moment of narcissism. And as Elliot Juris nicely states the thought, he says, narcissism explains the tendency to obscure that we are also constituted as being for another. For Hegel, however, being for itself is not necessarily antithetical to being for another. In particular, there is no reason to assume that narcissism, in and for itself, is pathological. It becomes pathological only insofar as it pushes consciousness to disregard being for another. So because we have this structure of being for ourselves, then there is going to be a continual temptation to disregard and play down our being for another. And this disregard can be played out structurally. For example, structurally, it is nothing but the history of patriarchy. Or structurally, it is nothing but the history of racism. These are means and modes and mechanisms of disregarding that give us the kind of assurance that our narcissism demands by making sure that there are objects that can be disregarded and therefore assure us of our infinite worth in response to their infinite abjectness. So on this account, patriarchy is even nastier than it looks on most accounts. I think only Hegelianism can actually make sense of the history of patriarchy. I think Simone de Beauvoir thought that too. It's another comment, maybe next year I'll teach that course. Conversely, being for another is Hegel's way of articulating that human agency is defined by dependence, by connectedness. Put this way, we may say that Hegel's terms, almost by themselves, and almost, and I want to be clear, it's almost by themselves, seem to project a normative ideal of subjectivity. Namely, an adequate conception of subjectivity involves a maximum acknowledgement of each as separate from every other, as truly being for itself, through an acknowledgement of each's utter connectedness to every other. The difficulty of you, now I'm going to suggest that this is not an a priori norm, this is not a principle, this is nothing. It's something. I'm going to call it a function, and I'll explain what that is. But this is why I wanted to get to it. It's hard to understand what this is, this structure of, that's what I want to tease out in the next 25 minutes, what Hegel means by a structure of separateness and connectedness, and how that, what that implies, and how that is going to somehow be meaningful for the rest of the structure of the book. Okay, so the difficulty of human relations for Hegel is the difficulty, he really thinks this is the difficulty, not the only difficulty human beings face. People can face hunger and starvation and drought. That's not a, and that's not a difficulty in human relations, that's another kind of difficulty. It can be both, right? Sometimes starvation is caused by human relations, namely expropriation of. The difficulty of human relations for Hegel is the quest for a state of affairs in which human independence is balanced by our dependence, by our indefinite or unconditional connectedness to other, by our being bound and bonded to others. The bonds that connect us will not be bonds of love. Title to the book. The bonds that connect us are what Hegel calls spirit. So, whatever spirit is, it's the bonds of connectedness. It is, spirit is nothing but structures of separateness and connectedness. Every form of spirit is a certain structure of separateness and connectedness. Hence, what I called above the conceptual core of love that recognition elicits can now be specified as denoting a complex logic of separateness and connectedness, and hence the quality of the relation necessary for successful recognition. Whatever is meant by equality and mutuality, is in fact a relation in which the demands of separateness and connectedness are maximally satisfied. So what I'm suggesting, what I'm trying to do is drive out of your heads the idea that mutuality or equality or freedom, any of these are primitive terms for understanding human beings. They're not. I'm suggesting to you that the primitive terms for the fundamental understanding of human beings is a structure of separateness and connectedness, and that as we articulate the meanings of that moment, the notions of equality and mutuality and freedom and the like will emerge as features of it, and not as independent moral norms or episodes. So I'm going to say something like the fundamental structure of our relationship to others, as it works itself out in certain ways, is going to, how do I want to put it, engender by its forms of defeat, by the forms of dissatisfaction and failure, certain ideas of, let's call it again, mutuality or equality or the like, but that these cannot be thought of as fundamental, primitive terms in the comprehension of the human. So when I say that Hegel is introducing a new conceptual grid by the notion of recognition, I mean it. I mean, he thinks this is going to be the term through which every other fundamental concept gets its traction in its relationship to the quality of human life. So it's a huge conceptual shift. Hence, if you're feeling, whoa, I don't know what's going on, you're bound not to, because he's reinterpreting the whole conceptual territory. Well, I said something about maximal satisfaction of the demands for separateness and connectedness would be the satisfaction of self-consciousness in general. As it turns out, as I've been hinting, it turns out that figuring this out is long and difficult. Because the norm of human relations is various forms of misrecognition. And I have to then now talk a bit about that. Let me put it this way. What is going to count as a state of affairs in which both separateness and connectedness get their due cannot be determined a priori. Repeat. What is going to count as a state of affairs in which the moments of separateness and connectedness that structure the relationship of self and other that we call self-consciousness, and by the way, I haven't explained to you why my relationship to you should be called a relationship of self-consciousness. That's for next week. And you ought to be thinking about that. Why does he say this is a chapter on self-consciousness? Well, it's about a relationship to the other. Why is it other consciousness? Intersubjectivity. Why is this a chapter on self-consciousness? Something else hanging in the wind here. Whatever that fundamental structure is, it cannot be determined a priori. You can't provide a transcendental deduction of it. You can't deduce it from structural imperatives. None of it. I've suggested that there's a normative logic here, but the terms of that logic are themselves indeterminate. Under what conditions will a subject rationally feel that her demands for separateness, the demand for independence and freedom and self-determination and subjective satisfaction, are themselves satisfied? Under what conditions will her independence adequately acknowledge her connectedness with others? Will her connectedness with others feel satisfied and found to be satisfied? Well, Hegel tells us in paragraph 177 that we enjoy perfect freedom and independence only with an I that is a we, and is a we that is an I. Ain't that mysterious? I take it I is the moment of independence, separateness, and we the moment of connectedness. And they obviously switch places, right? I mean, a we that is an I and an I that is a we, right? all the structures of I and we, inadequate and adequate, are called Geist or Spirit. But this is just about as empty as saying that there be maximal separateness and connectedness, narcissistic enjoyment, and bound relation to others. So how are we going to get going here? How is any of this going to work? Elliot Juris nicely says, satisfaction is impossible without fathoming dissatisfaction. So the problem with traditional philosophy is it wanted to know what the good is, what was satisfaction. And therefore it looked in the wrong place. So we might put the point this way. If satisfaction is impossible, without fathoming dissatisfaction, this is because misrecognition is unavoidable, then the fact of misrecognition and its unavoidability engender certain strategies of accommodation rather than emancipation. That is, rather than admit our dissatisfaction, we make up stories about the meaning of our dissatisfaction that are meant to be satisfied. God, the revolution, utopia, the moral law, truth, all of these are fantasies of accommodation that hide the very dissatisfaction that we desire. So we might say that we can only discover or uncover or generate what is going to count as a correct and adequate balancing of separateness and connectedness through a series of experiments and attempts to find a way of life that does the work of acknowledging both demands. Satisfaction, then, is going to be something like a life achievement, and finally, an historical and cultural achievement. That, for Hegel, it is going to be true that whole histories of human beings have been histories of human misery, that history is a slaughter bench, and that the possibility of human satisfaction is a very, very late arrival, and at that, only a trace within the present life. Because we're beginning to understand what it means. But all this, again, to say is that it is not a question of an a priori norm. That there really is a history, and it's the history of these attempts to find forms of life that answer to fundamental structures of separateness and connectedness. Okay, so this tells us something about the argument of the chapter on self-consciousness, which, on the face of it, the status of the chapter, I take it, is deeply obscure. It's pretty obscure to me. And Hegel's way of proceeding does little to clarify the obscurity. At what level are we to take this? Where is this situated? What does it mean in relationship to these problems we're talking about? I mean, we can read the text, the master-slave dialectic, the master does this, the slave does that. What's it about? Right? That's why I said we need to step back. it's unclear what it's about. Well, here's my working hypothesis. The chapter on self-consciousness, as a whole, corresponds to what Freudian analysis or psychoanalysis goes under the name of metapsychology. What I mean by that is that the chapter on self-consciousness is not a psychology, that's for sure, but then I take it that Freud's great achievement was to de-psychologize psychology. I take it, oh God, I can see the bad looks. The important point about everything that goes on in Freud is it's psychology. When we often we say, you know, what's the psychology of that? We're asking for what are the mental mechanisms. But what Freud shows that mental mechanisms are not merely the way the mind works, but they're fundamental structures of human relations. So that what we talk about psychology isn't about the psyche, you know, what the mind does. It's how the human being has a world at all in virtue of those things. So Freud takes the psychology out of psychology and gives it, we might call, structural significance. Well, the chapter on self-consciousness, in it we're going to be faced with a primitive story, and now let's think about what happens. Very briefly. In this chapter, we're faced with a primitive story about how self-consciousness first appears as self-consciousness. So we're not asking about the origin of self-consciousness. He says, we have self-consciousness. The question is, how does it appear on the scene? How do we become aware of ourselves as self-conscious beings? Or more exactly, what is the path we take to assure ourselves that we are truly self-conscious beings? That's what the people who are going to enter into the battle are asking. Not if they're self-conscious, but how can I assure myself that my self-conscious of myself as being the center of the world is true? How do I get affirmation, assurance, reassurance of my standing as an utterly independent being? Well, in this account, it turns out that originally we are utterly dependent on very, very powerful others. About how the story goes on, those very powerful others come to stand for us as both ideals of what we want. We all want to be masters, so they're ego ideals, and as fearful powers we must obey, since we are utterly dependent on. So about how, in that experience of dependence, we learn to repress and internalize our natural desires. So the other is also a superego. So the master is ego ideal and superego. And learning how to repress our desires, that is, learning how to mediate each and every desire through the other, through the master. Learning that no desire is given. Learning that there are no natural desires. That there are no desires I can call my own immediately. We learn a different relationship to objects. Hegel calls it work, as opposed to mere doing. And about how in learning the discipline of work, we discover another route to our independence than the one of struggle originally pursued. Say, make a world. Now, Hegel will go on to specify certain fundamental ways in which we imaginably work through the complex experience of bondage, of being these little people who have these dominating masters, and therefore our disappointments and dissatisfactions. And that's what stoicism, skepticism, and the unhappy consciousness are all about. They're imaginary ways of living this unsatisfactory situation. Said this way, and I think this is the way we need to take it, Hegel's story, which is sometimes read as something like a state of nature, is best understood, or sounds awfully like an account of the basic moments of infant development, reaching through the adolescent years, but stopping well short of adulthood. In this light, the demands of separateness and connectedness that both regulate the narrative and develop out of it, both become aware of it, emerge.
Building's closing in 15 minutes.
Okay, thank you. There's always a punchline. These structures of separateness and connectedness emerge as formal and therefore abstract normative functions of subjectivity independently of what is going to count as satisfying them. So that my suggestion is that understanding this emergence of this structure of the master-slave, which is going to be this structure of separateness and connectedness, says that there are certain functional requirements for being a self-conscious human being that must be satisfied in part in certain ways, and that is subject, but that there's no telling from the mere functional requirement. I want to get functional requirement. Anything that's going to count as a human relationship will have a structure of separateness and connectedness. Even the master and slave is a structure of recognition. Everything that is human is a structure of recognition. Shot through with misrecognition, with failure, right? But so we're always working within a structure of certain functional requirements that are both necessary, but their necessity is never, in the forms that they originally arise, satisfied. Hence, this fundamental structure is going to be a form, let's say, but a functional form that has certain demands, but we do not know what is going to count as the satisfaction of those demands. And the only way we can discover what is going to count as the satisfaction of those demands is through dissatisfaction. Hence, despair. So we can put it this way. He will discover that every form of recognition has, as a moment of it, a misrecognition, which then will engender by itself a demand for further transformations of the structure of our relationship between us. Okay, let's...
let me stop there before we get shot and everything new.
And we will start with the master-slave itself, or paragraph 174, 175 issue.